Today, we're going to hear about what the RM of Yellowhead does to create local connectivity in their community.
Perfect. So can you tell us a bit actually about how it all got started then?
Okay, so do you want the Reader's Digest condensed version, or do you want a little more in depth or something in between? I mean, I was with it right from the get-go from envisioning this thing, so I can do as much as you want.
In depth would be amazing. No, that'd be fantastic.
Okay, so who, what, when, where, and how would probably be the, and why, I guess,
yep,
would probably be where you want to go. It can get long. I probably am going to avoid some of the technical stuff because it probably wouldn't mean anything to you. But this started almost exactly 10 years ago. I was chairman of the school board at the time. And as chairman, I had access to not only the money that we were paying the provider at the time to connect our schools, but the struggles the schools themselves were having with those connections. And, you know, where the vision from senior management, where they saw their needs going in the next 5 to 10 years. So it became apparent that the current level of provision was not sufficient. I think it was NetSet at the time that was connecting our schools via microwave. And they were giving, I think it was 10 megabits to the small schools and 25 to the bigger, two bigger schools. And we had experienced a declining enrollment, which a lot of rural divisions struggled with, and we were also struggling with it. And so the senior management decided that the only way they were going to maintain a broad availability of different courses was to have a teacher standing in a particular school teaching to two or three other schools, because you can't have, of course, a teacher standing in front of six students at $80,000 a year. So you have to have some economies of scale. It was clear that the current bandwidth that we were getting was not anywhere near sufficient in order to be to enable that to happen. And so, as I said, I knew the money we were paying. So we thought, well, what we'll do is what other school divisions had done. We'll put out a request for proposals. And so we did that. We put out a request for proposals, and we received a number of proposals, one of them being from NetSet. And they told us that they could go up to 100 megabits on the main schools and 50 megabits on the small schools, which would be adequate for the time. But the question was, you know, long term, is that, you know, the solution we're looking at long term? And then, of course, we got the quote for the money. And it was significant. It was a lot of money. We had talked to the folks at Rolling River School Division and asked them what they had done. And they had gone with Westman Communications to bring fiber to their schools. But in looking at what they'd done, Westman had made a deal with them that the school division would pay, I can't remember the exact figures, but millions of dollars. And Westman would then put the lines in for them. And then they would run the network for them at so many thousands of dollars per month. So the math started to really look unfavorable, because what we saw when we talked to them, that they were paying the money up front, then paying monthly money, and then they didn't own the network. And so they couldn't, nobody else could do anything with it. And so myself and the senior management and the board that I worked with at the time said, you know, this didn't make sense to us, that, you know, paying all that money and you wouldn't own what you had, and you would simply be paying further as years went on. And so we asked for another set of proposals to just sink fiber to connect our schools. the thought of the internet hadn't even been broached yet. All we wanted to do was connect our schools to provide for these online classes. So we got some proposals from fiber.ca out of Winnipeg, from, I think it was Rural Networks, R-O-H-L, and again from Westman Communications, and I believe even NetSet had said they could probably do it. And so we looked at all of these proposals, and they were quite different in the costing. And but it became clear that if we went with the one bid, that we would actually end up paying less having fiber than we were currently paying for NetSet to deliver like 10 megabits if we owned it ourselves. And so we decided to go that route. We engaged a fellow out of Winnipeg, Don Reese was his name. He had been worked with one of the school divisions in Winnipeg and had connected fiber to them and was now a consultant. So we hired him as a consultant to work with fiber.ca, which was the winner of the bid, to put together a plan and to sync fiber for us. So we have fiber running from Inglis, if you know your map at all, up at Inglis, down through Binscarth, because these are towns that have schools of ours, and then over to Birtle, and then down to Miniota, across to Hamiota, and then from Birtle to Shoal Lake, and then from Shoal Lake up to Oakburn, Rossburn, and Wewesekapo. Now, the Wewesekapo thing was very interesting because it was the first Nation school in the region to be connected to fiber, and it was connected by us through our project. But while the build was being discussed and the plan put together, myself and Dave Juice, who was the IT supervisor for the school division, thought that maybe it might be something if the municipalities had access to this fiber themselves, that there might be some rural development, you know, outcomes that would be positive if they had fiber. And so we put together this dog and pony show, PowerPoint, you know, PowerPoint. And we visited all the rural municipalities in the region, and I'm talking many of them, Dave Juice and myself, and explained to them what fiber could do for their municipalities in bringing high-speed internet, or really high-speed internet, versus what was currently available through, basically through NetSet, because MTS was the only other game in town at the time with their twisted pair. You could only get 3 megabits of speed, so it really didn't function very well. So NetSet was really the only player that gave you anything, and even then it was 5. So in the end, there was only 4 municipalities. Sorry, 3 municipalities that said that they wanted to have their own fiber. So when the fiber was blown in, there was extra fibers put in those conduits that the municipalities could then buy in and own. And so the Hamiota Municipality, Prairie View Municipality, and Yellowhead Municipality decided that that was something that they wanted to do. So they actually gave us the go-ahead via their council order to provide fibers for them. The struggle that we had is how do you now administer this kind of hobnob collection of owners of the fiber? And so the suggestion was that we form a cooperative, and that the cooperative would own the fiber, and the partners would pay basically what the fiber cost, but it would be paid to this cooperative as a membership fee. And because we blew in all sorts of extra fibers, if other municipalities changed their mind down the road, they could then also purchase shares and have their own fiber. And this was true for Hutterite colonies or First Nations communities, anything that was sort of a local government. If you look at the Articles of Incorporation of the Fiber Co-op, which I was the president of for the first 3 years, so pretty familiar with it. It was one of the stipulations of the articles that local governments of any sort would have the ability to buy shares in fiber co-op. Of course, in the early days, cash flow is a concern. And so, you know, how do you pay for it all, right? This is quite expensive. It ended up being $4.6 million to put it in. And the fiber share of the municipalities worked out to just under $500,000 each. So the co-op was set up with a number of shares equaling the 4.6 million. And the school division simply paid for the extra shares. So they were able to get a 20-year debenture from the province, which they would pay then over the next 20 years for this $3 million or whatever it was that was not covered by the three municipal partners. And the deal was that over the years, if you sold more shares, then that would go to pay off that debenture or pieces of it. And subsequent to that, there's been a share that has been sold, and there's currently discussions with another municipality, which I probably can't name today. So it looks like there'll now be another share being sold. So this goes then toward the extra shares that the school division had to purchase. And so it's all kind of working out that way.
Don,
but then
can I jump in there I have a question, sure. Actually. So This is fantastic, and I hope I don't derail you with my question. But I noticed, so you said, you know, Shoal Lake, Hamiota, and Prairie View. Interestingly, those three are all like neighbors and in one part of the school division. Was there, besides the financial piece, and, you know, it definitely is a substantial outlay for rural municipalities, was there another reason the other sort of dozen or so municipalities didn't sign on?
Yeah, I guess one could put it down to relationship. Because I worked with the school division, I knew the people on council in Birtle. And of course, I live in Yellowhead, so they're all friends and neighbors. And in Hamiota, not only did I know people, but Dave Juice, who I said went with me, lives in Hamiota. So we had a relationship with these people. They trusted us. In one case, it was strictly financial. The municipality just couldn't do it. They couldn't come up with the money. In the other cases, it's because that, like, who are these guys coming to see us? You know, with this harebrained idea that's never been done before, and they're asking us for a whole potload of money. So that's why. It's strictly relationship, right?
Perfect. Thanks so much.
Okay. Anyway, so carrying on, where was I? Oh, yeah. I can get derailed a little bit. So the money piece of it. So that's how we handled the initial, you know, the build cost, as it were. But now operationally, what are we going to do? Well, if you're a municipality and you bought shares, you don't care whether the schools are connected. The school division does. They want their schools to be able to talk to each other, you know, via high speed. But the municipalities want to deliver, pardon me, internet to their people. How do we do that, right? And this is the critical piece of it. I've had calls from municipalities in southern Manitoba, from British Columbia, from all over the country, basically asking, how did you do this? And this is the sticking point. How do you get internet traffic to your own fiber network? We were, I guess, fortunate in that we had Shaw's main backbone go right down the railroad track and had a main booster location in Shaw Lake. So we were able to create a contract with Shaw. It was very expensive. Shaw did not play nice, in my opinion. So we spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to break into that line, and we paid, I'm thinking it was $9,000 a month for transport to 167 Lombard in Winnipeg, which was Hurricane Electric, I think. So it was quite expensive to do this, but we did the math, and you always got to do the math. If we had 200 people each times three municipalities, we would be generating enough pretty much to cover that cost spread over a number of years. 200 people isn't a lot. But then we had an opportunity presented to us. Westman Communications came to us and said, listen, I understand you're going to lay some fiber. We would like to contract four strands of fiber to various locations on an irrefutable right of use for 15 years or 20 years, whatever it was. And how much do you want? So we come up with a figure using our consultant out of Winnipeg. And so Westman, which I think this piece of it, I'm not going to get in specific because this is kind of their deal. But we agreed to a costing, and so they ride our fibers throughout this region. And the small towns like say Inglis, they'd have never got Westman without us. So even those people that don't use our service benefit from the fact that we exist. And it goes even further than that. As I said earlier on, NetSet was kind of the only game in town. And so they're a for-profit company. And whether you recall or not, 3 or 4 years ago, Charlie Clark was named Businessman of the Year in Brandon. You only get to be Businessman of the Year if you're a good businessman. And how you be a good businessman is by generating profit. And so we saw single moms with three kids working two jobs and their kids at home using Charlie's internet and getting a $400 a month bill for the data. So even though Charlie was a good businessman, he was not good for the poor among us. And so this was the catalyst, the reason that we said we have to do something. Because the playing field is not level. And you see this with Starlink, great service perhaps, but only a few can afford it. What about the ones that can't? So what we've seen is not only did Inglis benefit from our existence, even though they signed up with Westman, we see rural people, even though they don't sign up with the municipal internet, the cost of NetSet or now ExploreNet has dropped considerably because we exist. So that's why I'm a strong proponent of the involvement of municipalities in delivering communications and internet, because it creates that level of competition in the marketplace that you don't get when you have two companies that are both profit-oriented. The prices keep going up and up and up because they're profit-oriented. This is their business, whereas we're service-oriented. So we haven't raised our prices in 7.5 years because we are running at a significant surplus. So why would you do it? I'm off on a tangent. Sorry. That's what I call my soapbox.
No, Don, yeah. Just so you know, that's really appreciated. And Again, you would have gone over it in the consent. One of the things we are doing is we're pulling out little soundbite clips to sort of help explain things to audiences. We're going to post those on YouTube. We might come back with that, the importance of municipal service. We might come back and pull that out, and we'd review it with you before we posted it. Right. But that is probably the best description of the importance of municipal service from a pricing perspective and a service for people, like an affordability perspective, that we've heard so far. So that was fantastic.
So going down that road, before I go on to some of the other build stuff, do the math. So you've got someone, let's say with NetSet, and they're paying, even just the basic was $100 to $120 a month at the time. Even if you didn't go over your data cap, you're paying $120. You've got an MTS telephone. MTS was, I think, $85 a month at the time for their hardwired home phone service. And you've got satellite TV, which you're also paying $150 a month for. So you add those three together, it's almost $400 a month times 12 months. So they're paying $5,000 a year for communications and entertainment. Now that they have the ability to have our municipal internet, $55 a month for your internet, $10 a month for an IP phone, because our internet service is way more than you need bandwidth for to run an IP phone. Plus you can do streaming services. So now you can pick Disney this month, Amazon next month, Crave TV the month after that, and only pay that $15 a month for your entertainment. So now you add 55 and 15, which is 70, and another 10 for your phone is 80. Now they're paying $1,000 a year versus five. How much impact rurally will that make if you have 1,000 people that do it? Because a municipality has to have at least 2,000 people to be a municipality. So if you've got 50% of the market share, how much you just dump back into the rural economy? And the municipality itself has, which I'm probably not going to tell you, significant surplus. And we've got four full-time jobs out of it, which roll through the economy, talking rural development. This is absolutely gargantuan to a municipality to do this. Some of it's been good planning, some of it just plain dumb luck. It's just kind of how it worked out. I used to work with NetSet as an installer years ago, so I kind of know their system. And at the time when I was with them, and I have no idea, of course, nowadays what they've got, but at the time they had about 3,000 clients, and they had three technicians. We've got a third of that, and we've got four technicians, because the surplus that we're running is put into manpower, whereas in a for-profit company, the surplus is taken for the owner or the shareholders. It's just a different mindset. And don't get me wrong, for-profit companies serve a function. And if you want a higher level of security and maybe encryption, the for-profit companies can deliver that. And you pay for it, obviously. So I'm not saying they don't have a place, but a rural municipal offering keeps everybody with their pencils sharp. And that has a huge impact. The system doesn't get away on you. Where was I with the build? Okay, so go ahead.
I was just going to say that, and so we asked earlier about why other municipalities in Park West region didn't come on. You've talked to municipalities, like you said, across Canada and beyond, that have sort of reached out to find out how this happened. What's your take on why more municipalities don't do this themselves, or don't do this in collaboration with school divisions or other sort of institutions?
Really good question. And there's an answer to that. Why are we unique? So I told you earlier on that we talked with our neighbors at Rolling River School Division. And they're not alone in this. Every school division that we talked to, Rolling River included, did something that we didn't do. They signed that contract with the Westmans, the Shaws, the NetSets, to bring them their fiber connections. They do not own those lines. Municipalities can't tap into them because the for-profit companies don't like us. They don't want us because we're an impediment to their business model. And that's why they can't do it, because the school divisions have all gone and signed these 20-year contracts and don't own their fiber. And now if they want to do what we did, could have cost them millions of dollars because they got to relay all new fiber. So that's why. In the case of this one municipality I was talking to in British Columbia, there on the east side of Kelowna, Lake Okanagan, and they have no backbone. Like we have Shaw, like I said, running right by Shaw Lake. So what if you build a local network? How do you get to where, you know, there's an entry point for data for the world? And so we were lucky to have Shaw going by us that we could just tap into. It used to be, and this is another thing that ticks me off, used to be you could use Manitoba Hydro. But I don't know whether you follow this stuff or not, but the previous government signed a deal with ExploreNet so that ExploreNet could use the fiber line way up north where they're trying to get better service. But in signing that agreement, now nobody else can use it other than ExploreNet. So, yeah, I think they were hoodwinked by the people that did the contract. My opinion, obviously, I have no inside knowledge to anything. But so you could have used Hydro in the past. In fact, that's what NetSet did. They used the Hydro fiber line that ran from Brandon to Winnipeg. But anyway, so really, your options are disappeared. And it's because the for-profit companies try and make it that way. They even buy up or have in the past bought up frequencies to make sure we couldn't use them, even if they didn't use them themselves. I'm probably getting off topic here. And so our local MP, Dan Mazur, has been successful in getting a bill through Parliament that allows for kind of transparency. And so, and the federal government now allows us to use the 6 gigahertz bandwidth, even though it's a licensed bandwidth. So in other words, you can buy a license for it, but you can't buy a license for it and not use it. So therefore this public domain 6 gigahertz idea is being protected because those larger companies can't come in and just buy up all the frequencies and keep us little guys out of there. So the government is kind of cluing into some of these things, and I'm really off topic. Anyway, so what did we do? Hamiota decided that they wanted to do primarily fiber to the home. And the rural, of course, was done with microwave. Our 4 technicians that we have here in Yellowhead now do all the work for Hamiota. And Hamiota is a little different in that it's a smaller municipality. And so their options are limited. They're kind of surrounded. So they don't have a lot of room to grow to the extent that we have. And so to have their own people doing the work, a little bigger problem for them. And so we've contracted with Hamiota to just do everything for them. It's been working out really well. I guess the jury is out on whether that was the better way to go. When we talked with Hamiota about it, they were pretty clear on what they wanted. They wanted to do the fiber to the home for their people. And there's nothing better than fiber. I mean, that is the Cadillac. But Cadillacs cost money. And so it'll be many years to pay for that Cadillac. So it was, when we're running surpluses, they're doing debt servicing. So it's a little tougher initially for them. In 20 years, of course, that all starts to flip over, because with fiber, you don't have to ever upgrade, or you just change the gear on the end of the line and you get more speed. Whereas with microwave, like we did, there's some significant upgrades that you run into. I still think our decision was probably the best one for us anyway, because wireless technology is getting better and better and better. In fact, the latest technology that we're getting, it's 6 gigahertz is the frequency. We have a new connection running in Shoal Lake that is running fiber speeds via, it's running 650 megabits down and about 400 up. So, and we're limiting it. It could do gigabit if we wanted it to. So I still think our way of, and again, it's not great planning, it's just kind of dumb luck. The industry has gotten better and better. So we've kind of lucked into that. And we can deliver that 500 megabits to the farm now, if, you know, with this new technology. Our neighbors, we have been in conversation with a couple of them, and it seems like they think they've missed the boat, and they may be right in that it may be beyond the time frame to actually start doing this themselves. So actually we've started building out into our neighbor's area at their request, and they're putting up towers for us. So we're, as Yellowhead Broadband goes, we're just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's certainly been a tremendous success. We did have a meeting with NetSet before this all began, and I could tell that they were concerned that they were, how to put this politically correct, they didn't think we could do this with a volunteer board of directors. And there was struggles initially, but we did get through them. So it's actually run with a volunteer board. So yeah, works great. I think that's getting close to where I wanted to end off on. Or anything that you want to know further that's come to mind?
Joel, not sure if you want to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, this has been great. I didn't want to take anybody down a technical rabbit hole if we were still talking about it. I love the emphasis on the relationship building and the trust that's required for this type of thing. It's the first time I think that I've heard of a commercial network riding over a cooperative line. That's amazing. I love that. Just a couple of questions. So 6 gigahertz spectrum. So that's, you are able to operate in that licensed spectrum right now. Can you kind of maybe go into that a little bit more? How that's being controlled, or how, okay, and how you have access, and what kind of cost came with that? Because normally those are very, very expensive licenses, right?
That's a really good question, because this is all pretty new stuff. So the technology behind it is, how do you protect those licenses that are in place? And so what they've done is, these access points, when they fire up, before they start connecting to anybody, they connect to a location server, which is actually being housed in the States right now, and it knows where all the licenses are. And so it will actually control your power output, or it could deny you using that particular chunk of the bandwidth entirely. And we've run into that. Actually, we have right now a backbone link running from one location to Newdale. And we set that power level up as high as those were allowed to, right? And the next morning was half. So we said, what the heck? Well, it was because it logged in to the location server, and the location server said, no, down the road a few miles, somebody has a license that's close to that frequency, so we're only going to give you half that. And so we can just now shift the frequency and go back up in power. But that's how that's being controlled. The 6 gigahertz bandwidth is huge. We also have access to this same location server, and it gives you a graph of who's got what where in your area. So to avoid those adjustments that happen automatically, you can just pick a free frequency. You're right in the cost of the licenses. It goes beyond what we would be able to do and maintain our costing to the rural subscribers. And of course, as you heard earlier, our goal is not the guys that can afford ExploreNet, but the ones that can't. And we saw this so clearly during COVID. Our First Nations communities were functioning perfectly with online schooling. Others were not. We had people driving to grandma and grandpa's place at Bernal from some other parts of Manitoba just to do their online schooling or work from home, because the internet that grandma and grandpa had was better than what they had. So that's our goal, to make it affordable. So the equipment for the unlicensed, if you're going to do a long distance backhaul, which we have a long distance one set up into Sandy Lake right now, it's a little more pricey. The license is nothing. It's open for use. So we don't have to pay anything for license, as long as we don't interfere with other people's licenses. But the 6 gigahertz bandwidth is huge, so that's not a problem. The equipment, the equipment's a little pricey. For long distance, it works out to about $5,000 in the end. But if you've got, it doesn't take many people to pay for that. And again, we don't have to worry about shareholders wanting their 30% return on investment. All the municipality wants is, are you going to cover that this year? So to cover a $10,000 investment, if you get 10 clients, you've got it. So it's almost nothing. We can do this easily. And there's another, we've been playing with actually some subscriber 6 gigahertz radios, and they can be set to point to point. And they don't go quite as far, but they're cheap. They're like only $400. So we can do 6 gigahertz point to point all over the place, free up all sorts of 5G bandwidth. And of course, when you do that, you can start to deliver more speed to your subscribers. We're also playing with 60 gigahertz. I don't know if you looked at that at all, but they now have 60 gigahertz multi-point, point to multi-point. Doesn't go very far, but if you have a bunch of businesses in town that say, yeah, I need gigabit internet, hey, we can do that, no problem. So it goes back to where I said that either it's not necessarily good planning, but dumb luck. We can now deliver fiber speeds cheap, so we don't have to pay for the investment of the fiber to the home.
What about the technical workforce? You've listed a few names. You started with some people who had the know-how already and kind of capitalized on that, so that was great. But are you seeing, what's the plan for future support to the user level, to the network level? Are you growing yourself some network admins now and look planning for the future?
We have 4 full-time technical people. We also have a secretarial or administrative person. Again, because we run a surplus, we don't necessarily want to hand that surplus over to the municipality to spend on sidewalks. So we hire more people at their blessing. I mean, everything is done with the blessing of the municipality. So we have, and we're fortunate, we have a young lad that was living in Winnipeg working for the city of Winnipeg, doing networking for their stoplights or something like that. And his parents live locally. And so when we were looking to hire somebody, they phoned him and said, hey, get out of the city. So he came and we hired him. Another fellow did tower work out in Alberta, but decided that he wanted to take over his parents' farm So he's here, kind of farming and working full time with us. And then there's another young lad who was working at Heights in Vancouver. And his parents have relatives in Yellowhead. And so the whole family moved out here, and he applied for a job with us. And we have trained him. And a smart young man, really good at the computer end of things. So, you know, setting up email servers and whatnot. He's and routers, he's really good. And then another fellow who has been with us right from the start, who we trained right from the ground up, who doesn't do tower work, but does not only fiber splicing and does a lot of the work in Hamiota on the fiber lines and the switching and routing, but does some of the nastier work like phoning clients when they haven't paid. So he's, I mean, you need that too, right? So we have four really good guys. As we build out into Sandy Lake, as I mentioned, we have a backbone going into Sandy Lake. We will require another person. And so it's quite conceivable that by the end of this year, we would have five technicians and a secretarial staff paid for by the broadband. So that's a pretty good increase in employment for a small rural area. I mean, where do you get five jobs?
It's amazing and awesome that three of those people did what we always read about, which is actually come back to the rural, right? Like you actually drew people back into the community who wouldn't probably not have come for any other reason, right?
Yeah.
This might be a little bit of a tangent, but as far as their development, though, those four, like you kind of gave the background on how they came. As they need to learn new stuff, as you're bringing on new technology, is this all really on-the-job training? Are they just kind of watching YouTube and learning themselves? Or are they kind of like self-determined learning at this point for as things change and keep fresh?
Yeah, that's a good question also. So we make use of training courses that are offered. The last one was, I think, put on in Brandon, working at Heights and tower rescue and stuff like that. We also have access to our main provider for the equipment that we use. It's MBSI out of Medicine Hat, I believe. And they do training for us. Also, Cambium Networks out of the States runs online courses for our guys. So we do send them in person if it's economically feasible to do so. We also have had people come to us and do training locally. Most recently was a fellow came and did a training course on fiber switching with can't even remember the name of the switch. Anyways, what Hamiota uses. So it came to us and trained our guys because we were going to be doing the service work for Hamiota. So they needed to have that level of training. So we take advantage and mostly in the wintertime. In the summertime, of course, they're busy with build and outside work. But in the wintertime, we concentrate on training. Yeah.
And then I guess this is probably a Wayne question, but overall kind of adoption by the general population, like you said, like people are paying for it, they're obviously doing it, but what are they really utilizing it for, and what kind of an impact has it made beyond just watching Netflix or whatever?
Right. So the biggest thing, of course, the attraction has been the money piece of it, right? Because where else are you going to get 100 megabit internet for $50? And then we provide, we have a deal with an IP phone company out of Toronto, voipmuch.ca, if you want to look them up. And they provide IP phone service for $9.45 a month. So we support that. So people know that they're not, you know, kind of out on a limb if they make that change from MTS to voipmuch, and they will port your phone number so you don't lose anything. So for like $65 a month, you get internet and phone. Well, right now, if you had MTS internet and the MTS phone, you'd be paying $150 a month. And if you have NetSense, it's even more than that. So usually it's the price point that attracts them initially. What do they use it for? Well, it varies from household to household. Obviously, the older people, all they want is the ability to phone somebody or Skype their kids. A lot of them don't use the streaming services simply because they don't understand them. Some do, and we're willing to help them through that, of course, because our guys aren't paid commission, they're paid salary. So we want to support those that use the service. So we do all sorts of strange things for folks. But largely older people, they just want to phone somebody cheap and Skype their kids. If you have a family, well, it can be anything. It can be the parents want to be able to do, learning from home when the kids are sick. But largely, it's mostly everybody's got their own device and they need enough bandwidth to do it. And they don't want to pay a whole bunch of money to get it. Every child under or over 12 has their own cell phone now or their own laptop. So it takes a significant amount of bandwidth. And if dad wants to, maybe do something for work, he doesn't want to have to tell his kids to get off their stuff. So in the evening, yeah, Netflix, Amazon, that sort of thing is probably the biggest usage. I think I alluded to it earlier, though, that during COVID, we did see the practicality of having good internet because so many people did not. And it was always those that are least able to catch up that were affected, because it'd be those families that struggle the most that didn't have the internet. So we leveled that playing field. So that answer that question?
Yeah, I think so. Is there any businesses? One of the things that we kind of noticed too is it's kind of hard to start that cycle where if you have poor internet, you don't typically have a lot of devices and you don't have a lot of your processes automated. Because if your internet goes down, six times a day or whatever, then you can't really trust it. I don't think the people who have poor internet use a lot of cloud services or anything. But if now you've got cheap and stable and fast capability, is it making a level at the business level? Is it bringing businesses to town? Are they automating themselves? Are they going online?
Well, they're largely automating themselves, but again, it's through that ability that we brought to the region. Some of the folks have gone with Westman Communications and have slowly gotten automated through them. But Westman wouldn't exist if we didn't put the fiber in the ground. So, right. So there's a lot of things that have happened that maybe we don't see directly. I mean, there are business clients that have come our way and have slowly increased their usage of it. One thing we have noticed, though, that those that haven't come our way and haven't gone with Westman either, it's because of email. Email makes the accounts sticky. If you have an @mts.net email and you're a business, you're reluctant to change that because all your emails are coming through there. There was a trucking company, local trucking company that had quite a few different email addresses that were struggling with the cost of connecting their two offices. There was an office in Strathclair and an office in Newdale, and they were paying like $1,200 a month for that connection. Decided that was too much, and so they came to us and said, "How much would you charge us?" Well, we're $55 per end, so $110 versus $1,200. No brainer. But to do that change, we had to do all new emails. And so how we did it was we left the NetSet emails or NetSet account live, just dropped the level of service so it was cheaper, but left those emails live and forwarded those emails to new Gmail emails. And so over time, they could then start to tell people without losing contact with anybody. And so it's sticky, it's difficult, and the business really has to have strong incentive to do it. And we've seen some cases where they say, I can't see myself doing that, so I'll stay with what I got. Yeah. And they do. So
no, that's very interesting. It's neat because you can port a phone number, no problem. But you're right, you cannot get rid of that domain name if you don't own that domain. Yeah. Very interesting. That's very cool. Yeah. I like your workaround though. That's a cute
Our motto is there's always a way.
There's always a way. If it's stupid and it works, it's not stupid, right?
Yeah, exactly. We've got farmers that their house is buried behind trees, but the barn is clear. So we put the main dish on the barn and then put a link over to the house.
Yeah. And in regards to that email solution, I mean, that's, again, it's not just price points. It's the level of service that you deliver is a different perspective than a for-profit company, right? Like, that's not a solution that many for-profit providers would go that extra mile for.
No, you never see stuff like that. We get calls from people, my internet's slow. Well, your router is 10 years old. Why don't you put a new router in? I don't know how. So we'll go out and do it for them. We'll take them a router and put it in for them. So you'll never get that anywhere else, that level of service. And that's why we become very sticky, because after a while, it's expected, right? Everybody gets judged against what you're doing. And so, and that's another reason why I'm totally sold on the notion of municipal, not for profit, but for service internet or communications, because there's so many people don't know how to do this stuff and they're hooked. What do? Well, in Brandon, you can phone my IT support or whatever it is to come and do it for you. But out here, there is nobody. There's me.
Yeah. And
if I'm getting old. I'm getting tired.
Well, and so following up on that, so you're talking about all those training opportunities that you line up, you're talking about sort of the coordination and even just managing the staff. That's all done by a volunteer board, right? Or is there one of those staff members that is sort of at a management level?
I guess that would be a partially answer. Right now, Debbie is the chairperson of the management board. I was in the past, but it's good to rotate people. So Debbie's taken that role on. And we do have a coordinator, that fellow that, remember I said, phone people that were delinquent in their accounts. He's actually a coordinator, but he has not been given management authority. And because we are small staff, if you start to give management authority to somebody, you start to get division in your staff. And so if they're mad about something, they're mad at Debbie. Not that guy. Yeah. Right. So that's kind of how we've seen going forward with a management board, is we give the one fellow the job of, assigning, priorities perhaps. Sometimes Debbie will override it. Sometimes I did. But it's usually, there's rationale for doing that. So we have a coordinator, but he's not management.
The other question I had was, you mentioned that there were some hiccups at first as you got going in with Yellowhead Broadband. Can you share just a bit more about that?
So how far back should you go? Let's go back to the laying of the fiber co-op. Of course, we didn't lay it ourselves, so we hired somebody to do it. And there's this graph that you can find online that shows when a project starts, everybody is way up here and excited. And then as you get into it, it drops way down in the valley and say, what on earth are we doing? We should never have done this. And then eventually it comes back up the other side. That's exactly what we experienced. And we experienced it for technical reasons. We experienced it with non-understanding amongst the partners. There were people in municipal governance that thought it was a bad idea. So they would throw up roadblocks and you know, legal things, and just a real struggle getting everybody that needed to be on board on board. Once council was on board, well, okay, we had that piece of it, but you know, your council is only one part of municipal governance. There's all sorts of other people involved. We had struggles with the company that actually laid the fiber. One of the pits was in the wrong place, and so on the diagram it said the pit was in a certain place, but it wasn't. And so when we signed the contract with Westman, they said, well, that pit's in the wrong place, you have to move it. So now the cost of moving that pit added to the cost of the build. There was struggles with the quality of the connections because the company that was hired to do the splicing spliced it to what they said were industry standards. But because we signed a contract with Westman, the contract stated a certain level of quality per splice as indicated by a tester. So we went back to the company that did the splicing and said, listen, you know, splices aren't meeting this contract. And they said, well, our contract isn't with them, it's with you, and this is what our contract says. So all of a sudden we had somebody insisting that such and such be done and somebody saying, no, we're not going to do it. So what do you do with that? So we said to Westman, well, you need it to this. Contract says that. I guess you'll have to do it and we'll have to pay for it to be done. So further adding to the cost. So some of it was being a little green, I guess, in dealing with people. Because these contracts are done by lawyers who have done this over and over and over again, who have run into some of these things and have, you know, dotted their I's and crossed their T's. And so we had two competing contracts that we had to get around, which we eventually did, but it's just delays and costs. Of course, the Shaw connection was another delay and a cost, but we got through it. In rolling out the initial microwave piece of it, of course, in my case, of course, I was probably the spearhead to this thing. The technology that I was familiar with was 15, 20 years old. So what we were handed with was different. And so it was a bit of a learning curve, you know, how to work with this new stuff. And so there was, I guess, early struggles in getting, you know, proper lines of sight. Simple things like these, the access points that we were using. In the fine print, it said they come with a 2-degree electronic down tilt. Well, that means you got to up tilt it 2 degrees to get full distance. We didn't read the fine print. So why are we only getting 5 miles out of these things? So, you know, those sorts of things. Of course, the types of equipment we used were cheaper, not industry grade. It was, you know, more what you'd use in a home. Again, because we only expected, you know, 100 people to join our system, those that really struggled. So we didn't think we needed these more robust pieces of equipment. Well, as we grew to 500, couldn't handle it. So now you start the upgrading process. So there was that. Engineering locations of towers was a struggle because the guy that we had hired to do the engineering of the locations and that somewhat of a disagreement with the municipalities where they wanted it. So, you know, all these sorts of, you know, different personalities enter into it. And it seemed like every week there was a new struggle of some sort. The money piece of it, of course, we struggled to get the partners to actually forward the money to the fiber co-op because of their internal struggles. And so you know, you can't buy the next roll of fiber until you're able to pay for it. So it was, and the school division, of course, was, had put their money in already, so they're not going to give you any more. So there was all sorts of struggles. You, whatever you can think of, we struggled with it. Certainly anybody that wanted to do it now, I mean, I could help them breeze through this stuff, but it was all learning curve for us.
Those all sound like kind of local issues you kind of work through. You learned your way through it, or you kind of experimented your way through it. You had mentioned earlier about Manitoba Hydro Telecom selling off the dark fiber to Explore. Were there external things? One of the things we're trying to do here too is look at common roadblocks or policy problems or things that, if they change, would have made your life a lot easier, like beyond the finances of it. Were there policies or regulations or things like that that you know, potentially we could advocate for changes that would help these types of rural projects?
Yeah, certainly there was one major one that we ran into. And I think it's been softened in the last year or two. But when we started this 10 years ago, there was, I think it was legislation that said school divisions could not in any way compete with private industry. And so that's kind of why the fiber co-op was formed, with the notion of the municipalities owning their own fiber. It wasn't owned by the school division. This was a workaround. Really, we went out on a limb. We didn't know for sure we were going to get away with this. But in the end, the government of the day said, well, okay, I guess we can let that go. Because the school division itself only ran its own network. It didn't run the fiber co-ops network. But that was a big one. So when you talk about why people didn't or don't do this, legislation is a big piece of it. If the school division owns the network, then at that point anyway, they simply couldn't. And then you're hooked.
Thank you very much for joining us. Please tune in next time for another episode of Connected MB.